which is also not a good thing to be
if you teach a college level astrophysics course. But anyway, like I said, I'm Bill. Please call me Bill. Don't call me Dr. Janish or whatever. I hate it. I'm not that old yet. You can call me Bill. I'm Ray. Is that
please call me Ray.
Ray, okay. I'm Bill. That's Ray. My office is right there. So if you want to come by for office hours, that's where you go. And Ray is
literally
right,
through Bill,
right
through
there.
The
so we're both right there, right outside the classroom. This is the textbook for this class. It's blue. We've never used it before. This is our first time going through this textbook. It's good, though. So this is going to be sort of a tryout for this. The reason I made it required, and I hate doing that, but I made it required because most of the homework problems are going to come from the book. So this is it. They have it at the bookstore, which is where they want you to buy things. I don't care where you get it. That's not my job. My job is to teach you the material inside the book. I'm sure you can get it for cheaper on Amazon or wherever else you buy books or find books these days. There is a copy of it on reserve in what will shortly no longer be the Astronomy Library, which is right next door. There's a shelf, a black shelf, right inside the door. It's on this side of the room. It has a bunch of textbooks. Yes.
What is it going to be rather than this on the library?
Like a lounge space, probably, for the rest of the year. I'm not sure. There's like chairs and desks in there if you want to sit before class or after class and study. That's a good spot. There's a couple other books in there, books that we've used in past semesters that you may find useful. There's information in there that you might get a different perspective on or something from this textbook. They are Astronomy, A Physical Perspective by Mark Kuttner, and Introduction to Modern Astrophysics by Carolyn Ostley. The second one is the better one, in my opinion. It's big and orange. Can't miss it. But you only need to have this first one, the blue one by Ryden and Peterson. There is a class webpage. That's not a clickable link, is it? Maybe if I do that, yes. Here it is. This is on a case server, so I can change this. I won't post announcements or anything on here. Those will go on Canvas or via email just to make sure that you all get them. But this is basically just a web page version of the syllabus, and there are links to what the homework assignments are on here, right? There are this also on Canvas, where you will turn in your homeworks. We'll talk about that in a second. The important thing about this page is at the bottom here. This is an updatable schedule that I will keep updated throughout the semester with, if the schedule changes, which it is likely to do, I will update this, make sure the readings are in the right spot, make sure the homework due dates are in the right spot. The really important thing about this is that this is where I will post the notes. I'm going to do notes on my tablet and export them in PDF. And I will post them here so you can just get the notes for the class. And I'm also recording this. I will post MP3s, which you can access by clicking the date for that day of class. So if you have to miss for some reason, I don't care if you come every day, but if you have to miss, you can get the audio recording so you hear what I said. I'm not gonna do video unless we really have to, because it's annoying to deal with, and I'm sick of watching videos of people. No offense to any of you, but I'd really rather we all be in the same room this time, if we can. I obviously haven't posted any of those things yet, so none of these links work yet. Also here is a link to the Google Calendar that I use to manage dates and stuff for the class. So as we schedule things, all the class lectures are there, homework due dates are on there, dates of the exams and stuff. If we do extracurricular, non-required, extra credit type things outside of class, those will go on that calendar. We will do at least one visit to the rooftop observatory, during the semester. That will go on that calendar. If there's relevant lectures or anything that, you know, you might be interested in, those will go on the calendar, that sort of thing. You can subscribe to it, but you have to log in with your case ID. There are sort of the standard distribution of work effort in the class. 45% on 6 homework assignments. Again, I said I'm terrible at math. Like, that's what, 9%? Is that right? Something like that. 8%? I don't know. 25% on a midterm exam, which will be, alas, right before fall break. Sorry, I know. And then a final exam, which is 30% of your grade, which will be during the registrar's scheduled exam time. It's the last fucking day. I'm so sorry. I wish I could choose. But that's when we have to do it. If for some reason that's really not going to work for you, talk to your navigator and they'll help you figure it out. What are we going to talk about in this class? It's right in the title, Stars and Planets. That's the really basic version of it, right? We are going to talk about basically how stars work, how they make their energy, how they don't collapse in on themselves or blow apart, how they form, how they evolve, how they die, how they group together in star clusters. And then we're going to talk about planets and how we detect extrasolar planets. That's going to be like basically the last week of class. And then the application of physical laws to study the universe, that is doing a lot of work. We're going to spend the first, 4 or 5 weeks talking about just basics. How do we know what we know? What are the particular astronomy things that we need to know to be able to describe everything? Units, how we know them, how we find distances, stuff like that. Disability accommodations, you get that in every class. Probably, you probably know the drill by now. You guys have all been here at least 1 year. Like I said, there's 6 homework assignments. You can absolutely work together. I don't care. I think people work better when they work in groups. We're gonna split off a lot into just little discussion groups and talk about things in this class. So feel free to work together, but please don't just have one person do the work and then everyone, do your own work. I feel like I have to say that, but I know you guys know the deal there. We're gonna accept homework submissions on paper or upload it to Canvas via PDF. I think, what grade you're gonna grade them, what would you prefer they do?
I prefer a PDF submission.
Okay, so.
Because if you hand me a handwritten thing and I can't read your handwriting, I'm not gonna try and read your handwriting.
So, yes, if you must submit things via paper, that's fine, but we would very much prefer that you upload it to Canvas as a PDF. A single file if possible. Sometimes there's 2 files and we don't realize, and then you missed half the work being graded because it's, if you are gonna scan something in, like you've handwritten it out, like you've worked through a problem, please, please, please make it as legible as you possibly can. Otherwise, see Ray's previous statement about not getting graded. And those will generally, that's the plan now at least, will be due during class. So I guess we'll collect them at the end of class. On your way out, drop it on the desk and we'll collect it if you're gonna do that, or upload it to Canvas by the end of class, the day it's due. So that's 2 p.m. on, I think they're all Wednesdays right now, but that will change. If things need to change, there will be a specific due date that you'll have to have it turned in by. Exams. As I said, we will have, that's up at the top there, okay. As I said, we will have 1 midterm, which will be on October 6th? 13th. Which is the last class before fall break. And there will be a final exam on the regularly scheduled date. For exams, I'm going to allow you to have one sheet, both sides of letter/A4 sized paper with whatever you want on it. Cheat sheet, but otherwise, it's not open book or anything. I can tell you now that just having a bunch of equations probably won't help you, but if you want to have them written down, there will be at least one or two math problems on an exam. So, you know, it's more, for me, exams are more about concepts, synthesizing what you know into knowledge and not just regurgitating numbers. Because, you know, it's a physical science, it means something, it's not just working problems. But you will, you know, we'll do problems. Obviously, you can't work together on an exam. I think I forgot to take that out when we did take-home exams during COVID. If you cheat during an exam, you fail the exam. If you do it more than once, please don't. I don't want to deal with it. Like I said at the beginning, for attendance, I don't care if you come every day. It's fine. We're recording things anyway. Hopefully the microphone can hear me across the room. But it's great if you come, right? But if for some reason you have to miss class for something, just don't bother. You don't have to email me. Just don't, you know. And we'll post the notes and audio. As far as the late policy goes, one out of six homeworks can be turned in up to a week late. No penalty, no questions asked. Just let me know you're doing it so I don't give you an F right away. That's up to a week. Obviously, if you have accommodations through disability resources or something, that supersedes that policy. And the disability resources policy supersedes mine is what I mean by that. And then any other late work, 20% per day, it's pretty standard. But if you have some otherwise legitimate reason, like you get COVID and you can't do the homework, let me know, we'll figure it out. You know, I'm not gonna be a massive hard ass about this because this is our first time in person for a while, and so we have to figure everything out again. This next item is perhaps the most controversial one in this class. Hopefully not too controversial. There's going to be at least three homeworks that you have to write some code in Python and get it to do something, because astronomy majors and minors need to know how to do code in Python for their professional careers, if that's something that they want to do. So we're going to start teaching it to you early. Don't worry about it. We're going to spend at least one entire class period talking just about Python, so we'll at least have all seen it. Before I ask you to do anything, if you need help, ask for it. There's going to be lots of resources for that this semester. You can ask me, you can ask Ray. There are going to be two, can't count again, two dedicated people who are going to serve as Python helpers for this class. They're senior undergraduates. They will be available for help. We will meet them when the time comes. We'll have them come in. We haven't exactly figured out their schedules and responsibilities yet, but they will be available. If you don't have the necessary computational resources, any old laptop is probably fine to do that sort of stuff. But if you want access to any of these wonderful computers to do that work on, or have questions, concerns about any of that Python part, let me know ASAP and we'll figure out something to do with that. Especially if you are, I know there are some senior engineers in this class. Who is an engineer? A few of you. If you really find it professionally, you know, unnecessary to learn Python, let me know. We can maybe figure out a different way for you to do that. But it's useful, right? You might want to learn another programming language. But the rest of you have to do it in Python. That's the one time I'll be mean this week. Okay, office hours. The last important thing you want to know. My office hours are going to be right after class, both days of class, for an hour, and I will be in my office, except today I have to go home, my kid is sick. Sorry. I have a 1-year-old kid, and she's been in daycare for a week, and she's already got just pouring out of her nose. So, I'm fine. I don't have any sickness. I wouldn't be here, I wouldn't do that to you. And then also, we will figure out a 90-minute block on Thursdays that will work best for the most of you, because I know some of you probably have to go to class right after this, can't stick around for the hour after, and Thursday is a not Monday or Wednesday day, so it'll be different. We will figure that out. That we'll do a poll or something with some options. But you can also, if I'm here, you know, just drop in. I'll be here pretty much all day Monday and Wednesday in the morning. And obviously in the afternoon we do this. And then Thursday I should be here pretty much every Thursday all day too. If I have to reschedule that, I'll let you know. But you can just drop in, or you can send me an email. You can send Ray an email. Hey, when are your office hours?
My office hours are Tuesdays from 10 to 11 in the morning and Fridays from 2 to 3 in the afternoon. But I also have that sort of, if I'm in my office and my door's open, need something, just come and ask. I'm here much more often than Bill is. I'm here all week, every day.
Ray is a graduate student, and so he has many responsibilities
yes.
that involve him being in this building all the time.
Yeah, I'm also
Tuesday.
The president of the Graduate Council of Arts and Sciences, so I'm here literally all the time.
Tuesday 10 to 11, Friday 2 to 3,
yep.
right? Can you read my handwriting okay? In the back, especially? Mostly thumbs up? Good. I can write small, so let me know if I need to write bigger, okay? I find this is better than trying to make you see this board. Even though it's, you know, you can see the board at the same time as the projector, it's... Why would you have to turn your neck like that? I don't... The only thing we ask about office hours is that if you have a particular question about the homework, please try something first, because if we don't know what you've tried, we can't necessarily help you the right way, right? If it's something that you like, the numbers are coming out wrong, that's different than I don't know where to start, right? So try something first. I won't be a complete hard ass about it. Ray might, because he's busier than me. But we will ask you to show what you've tried before we, you know. And we're not going to tell you the answer, obviously. There is a homework tips page, which is linked on the class webpage, which involves lots of text that I stole from Professor Mijos, who was here earlier. It's good advice, you know. Feel free to read through that at your convenience, but I highly recommend that you do. Also, linked on the class webpage is some information about Python. If you want to think about starting stuff with that now, feel free. This is a good resource. I wrote this one, I think. Maybe not. I don't remember. Here's the schedule. With the rest of our time today, which is however much longer it takes me to talk and then till 2 o'clock, like an hour, we'll talk about the history of astronomy a little bit, orbits, Kepler's laws. We'll continue that on Wednesday, talk about gravity and tides. As you can see, we're going to move quickly. We have a lot to cover. Next week, we'll talk about the sky, constellations, how we measure coordinates and setting and rising times, stuff like that. And then we have Labor Day. We'll talk about, on that next Wednesday, about basically light. We'll get out the neon tube things. We'll, you know, look at spectra and stuff. It's fun. Hopefully we're still in class by then, because that's week 3, and, you know, Zoom sucks for that. But hopefully we can be here. and not everyone has gotten sick. Then we'll do telescopes and some basic astronomical technique stuff, you know, how we measure distances and things like that. Cameras, things like that. We'll do then that weekend, that week, September 15th, we will do a day of Python instruction in class. Just trying stuff out, so bring a computer that day if you can. If you don't have a computer that you can bring, let me know. We'll get you set up on one of these for the day. And then we'll start in week 5 of 15, we'll start talking about stars and stuff. We'll talk about the sun, and then sort of your basic idea of the properties of stars, how we measure the mass, how stars make their energy, and how they get it out, how they evolve. And then that brings us to the midway point. We will do a full day of review on October 11th, and then have the midterm on the 13th, and then we'll have fall break. And we'll come back at it. We'll talk about a little bit more about stellar evolution, and then how stars die, things like black holes and supernova and stuff, and then star clusters. And then we'll do a week on star formation and what sort of material stars form out of. And then the rest of the time we'll talk about planets of various kinds. I realize that for some of you, planets are the reason you're here. So I'm sorry to front load you with stars and astrophysics stuff, but this makes more sense to me as a class structure, because you can't have planets without stars. So, you know. Any questions about the syllabus schedule? Yes.
Do you by any chance have a schedule, like readings before each class or something like that?
They're on here. That's what these numbers in green are. Those are readings from the blue book. This book is also the book for Astronomy 222. If you end up taking that next semester, you won't have to buy a new one, at least. So this covers both classes, which is nice. And in fact, it's like only two chapters of the book is 222. There's a lot to talk about with galaxies and cosmology. So yeah, readings are on there. They're also on the website. Any other questions? Cool. Have you all filled out your cards with your name, your preferred name, your, if there's any pronunciation you think I should know, your year and your major? Pass them forward, please. Yes. You may borrow the pen, yes. Because this is the one way I will be mean in this class. I'm going to make you talk amongst yourselves a lot and then randomly call on people to share what their group talked about. I know it's dumb, right? But I find you learn better that way. Sorry. Hopefully it's not too mean. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So, since this is an astronomy class, we should talk about astronomy and not just the syllabus. To start, I would like you to pair off, group of three, group of four, whatever feels comfortable to you. Talk about the question, how did astronomy become a thing? That is perhaps a poorly worded question. To rephrase, why is astronomy a science that we care about? You can think about all sorts of different things right with that, right? Like there's history, there's science, anything you want to talk about. Why is astronomy important? Why did it become a thing? How did it become a science that we care about? Anything like that. Talk about that for 3 or 4 minutes with your neighbor or person behind you or whatever. Whatever works best. Oh yeah, that's good. And introduce yourselves to each other. Of course. Thank you for calling.
You all got quiet. I assume that means you're done. We have a small problem because there are some duplicate names, which will be confusing. We have two Alexes. Welcome, both of the Alexes. Two Graces and two Kevins. So, best of luck to you. Whoever answers first gets nothing. No, I'll try to, you know, there's at least no degeneracy in the last initial, so I can call on someone specifically. Nathaniel, what did your group talk about? Where is Nathaniel? Yes.
So we talked about how stars were important for navigation and also for like telling time and the seasons, things like that.
Navigation, telling time. Grace Metz, is that what it says?
Yeah.
Yes. What did your group talk about? Indeed they were. We won't talk about that in this class, unfortunately, but sometimes there is a Sages class, which I guess Sages isn't going to be a thing anymore relatively soon, probably. So never mind that. There was a class about that. I guess Earl retired too, so he's not ever going to teach that again. So we have navigation, time, seasons, religion. Let's see. Sophia?
Hi. I think it's like a very, probably the most basic thing, how it started is it's nighttime and you look up and there's some shiny things and you need to know what that is.
Right.
Also, we mentioned all those things up there. Also, tides, like the ocean tides, and gravity.
I mean, when we didn't know that gravity was a thing until what, the 1600s?
Something.
Right? So, how do people explain that things did that when you let go of them? I don't know why I did that.
Just in case we didn't know what you meant by gravity.
Yes. those are all, yes, all good. Steve.
Yeah.
Good, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
I'm warm.
First of all, astronomy became a thing, you know, because people are always asking, why am I here, right? Ever since people have existed, the genuine curiosity is always there, right? Same way we talked about, you know, why we drink milk or eat salt, right? Somebody said, let's do that, you know, let's lick that rock. Cool, you know, but they're looking up and, you know, touching on the religion thing. What's going on? Why is it so shiny? You know, what's that other object? It doesn't look very shiny most of the time. You know, moon, sun, stars. It's the genuine existence, right? Like, you know, why are we here with this stuff? And let's explore more of that.
Absolutely. How many of you have ever licked a rock that you didn't know what it was before? Steve has, so there we go. Steve is the one true explorer among you, apparently. That basically covers it, right? Why are we here? Where did we come from? Like, I think whoever mentioned religion really kind of had it there, right? Because in a lot of ways, Ray was just telling me that he walked past someone on the street that said that astronomy is really new. It's a new science that we don't, you know, in some ways that's true. A lot about astronomy we haven't really known until the last 20 years. But in some ways it's the oldest science because people can see things with their eyes. And when you go outside at night and there's a big round thing in the sky that's bright and you don't know why it's there, you have to explain that somehow. You go out in the day and there's a big round bright thing in the sky, and when you look at it for too long you go blind. Please don't look at the sun. It's really bad for you. When you look at it you go, why? What is that thing? Why is it in the sky? Why is it here? And so, you know, how you explain those things has to turn into some structured system, right? So it starts out as religion, and then over the course of thousands of years, turns into a science where we can actually make predictions, do tests. Astronomy is a science, the same as all the others.
How is it different than every other science that you might do, take a class in college? Yes?
It's mostly observation. The dark film, touch the star, and land on the stars.
Right. Exactly. You can't actually do direct experiments with things out in space, right? How many times have we landed on a different planet or moon than ours? Less than 50, right? And it costs billions of dollars to do it one time. So you can't go out and poke a star and see what it does if you make it more massive. You have to make a lot of assumptions about what the underlying physics are, how stars work in general, how they got there, how they form, what they're made out of. You don't know any of that for 100% sure, because we can't go and take a sample of a star directly and pick it up and bring it back to the lab. We can put together what we think is a comparable system in the lab, but that's, again, there's a lot of assumptions there. So in a lot of ways, like you said, astronomy is an observational science. We rely on what we see, right? The observations, the photons, the light that's coming in, that's hitting your eye or your camera or whatever, that's all the information you have, really, about what's happening out in space. And so how you get from seeing something to explaining it, that's astronomy. So what is sort of the first major big system that some group of people put together to explain how the universe worked? That's maybe a poorly phrased question, right? Yes?
Well, I'm probably like the gods that people like made, like, no, just kind of explain with, like why, like,
yeah. Right, so like the brightest thing in the sky, the brightest not thing that's not the sun or the moon, right, is Venus. It's a planet. We know that now. But, you know, the ancient Greeks thought it was the goddess Venus or whatever her Greek name was, right? I can't remember that either. It's been so long since I've taken a humanities class. Artemis? No. Aphrodite, thank you. You know, Jupiter, Zeus, Mars is Aries, right? They thought they were the gods, right? The Greeks were pretty smart as far as, you know, people go historically. They figured a lot of stuff out. They measured the size of the Earth to pretty good accuracy in, like, the year 200 BC or something. So that's pretty good. They obviously got a lot wrong about the true nature of things, but they put together a pretty good model of what the universe looked like. It's called the geocentric model. You have probably heard of it before. What does the geocentric model look like? Does anybody remember? Yeah.
You assume that the Earth is the center of the universe, and then the sun and moon rotate around that, and then the sky is like a shell that rotates around that.
Right. So you have the Earth, you have the moon and the sun. They orbit around the Earth. And then you have the planets on orbits around the Earth, too. So let's see. You have the moon first, then the sun. Actually, it's not quite that order. So hang on. First, we have the moon. And then we have Mercury and Venus, and then the Sun. Why is that an important distinction to make? That's a rhetorical question, but think about it for a second. And then we have Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. And then around the outside, there's a big sphere. These are all perfectly circular orbits, by the way, because the Greeks strongly believe that things should be in perfect circles. you have this fixed sphere that never changed and never moved, where all the other lights in the sky were stuck to that sphere. So we'll call it the fixed sphere of stars. Something else you will learn about me in the next 15 weeks is that I'm bad at spelling when I'm writing by hand. So we have this fixed sphere of stars, right? And all these are on circular orbits, except the fixed sphere of stars, which just sort of sits there. So let's go back to the rhetorical question, which is not a real question. Why is it important to have Mercury and Venus in this model between the moon and the sun? Yes.
Because they could have seen them passing in front of the sun periodically, I think?
Yes. That's right. So occasionally, Mercury and Venus go in front of the sun and block out some of the light, and you can see, if you observe carefully by not looking directly at it with your eye, that there's a dot of something going across the sun during, it's called a transit. The last one that happened of Venus was in 2012. It was pretty cool. You guys were what, still in elementary school then? Kidding. How old were you in 2012?
12.
11? So maybe elementary school. Wow, I'm old. I am old. Right, so those can go in front of the sun. The moon can go in front of the sun. That's eclipses, right? Do we ever see Mars, Jupiter, or Saturn go in front of the sun? So they have to be behind it, right? There's a couple other planets that we know about. They're not on there, right? You may note there are two big ones in our solar system, Uranus and Neptune. They do not appear in the Greek geocentric model. Why not? Does anybody know why they don't appear in the Greek geocentric model? Yeah.
Because they haven't been discovered yet.
Yeah. They weren't discovered until the 1700s.
And the only reason we found them was because someone was really patient and had a big telescope. One of the things that they were trying to explain with this model is that sometimes when you sit and you watch a planet moving around the sky over time, that the planet will appear to be moving across the sky. I should just draw it instead of gesturing wildly with my arms. The planet will be moving across the sky. Things move from left to right over time in the sky, or right to left. It will turn around and do a little loop and then go back the way it was going before. Why would that happen? How do you explain that in this model? How do you have something that's just orbiting around the Earth like this? How does it go backwards in the sky? Talk about it for a minute. How would you get something to go backwards in the sky? If I were just walking around you as a group, right, you wouldn't see me stop and go backwards, right? I just did that now, but that's not. So group up again, talk about it. Perhaps importantly, I should mention that not all of the things in the sky do that.
right? The moon doesn't do that. The sun doesn't do that. But the planets do. Maybe that helps you with your explanation. Okay, Hannah. Where's Hannah? Did your group talk about how you really explain it or how the Greeks explain it? Just spinning in one spot also. Basically, yeah, that's how they did it, right? So they had these things, they added, so these are all orbiting on perfect circles, right? They added a second perfect circle called an epicycle, where instead of the planet orbiting on the big circle, it spins around a little circle that orbits on the big circle. Does that make sense? So they had this smaller orbit that looked like that, and it goes around like that. And so sometimes it's going forward, and sometimes it's going backwards around on its orbit. This model just got a lot less elegant, didn't it? So thinking about that now, how would you physically explain that happening? How would you get that to work?
It's got like a whole bunch of moons that are all in the same place. Looking up to like a binary system of some sort.
Yeah, that would be a way to do it. But then you'd have two things that would look like they were going around each other, sort of, right? How do you have one thing going around empty space? Maybe you have a black hole. We don't have those in the solar system, so you'd have to have like a piece of string tying it to the, there isn't a way that that works with the forces that we know about now, right? So this model works to explain what they saw to a certain amount of precision, right? So people start to think now, okay, maybe this isn't a great way to explain this, right? How do we make this model simpler? So we have the moon and sun and all the planets are orbiting the Earth. And the planets sometimes look like they're going backwards. And the way that we explain that is by putting all the planets on these smaller weird orbits called epicycles, so that sometimes they appear to be going backwards as the epicycle makes them turn around back the other way in their orbit. How do we make this model simpler? Right? What are we going to do to evolve this model forward in a way that it doesn't have as many circles in it? Because we still think we need circles to have orbits be circles, because they have to be perfect. But how do we reduce the number of circles and still explain how things go backwards in the sky?
Yeah, so you use the geocentric model?
And not necessarily. So talk about that for a minute. I think some of you were already getting at this a little bit. I saw you gesturing with your fingers, but talk about that for another 2 or 3 minutes. How do you go from all these circles to fewer circles? One circle per, I guess, is the way to think about it.
I agree.
You all got quiet again. Mark.
That's me.
Okay.
We said it was because of like a heliocentric model, so they changed it so it orbits around the sun instead.
They changed it so it orbits around the sun instead. I mean, yes, that's the correct answer, right? How is that model simpler? So what does the heliocentric model look like? We have the sun at the center. Then what? Do you remember from whatever elementary school or whenever you, maybe you didn't learn it. Maybe this is the first time.
Mercury.
Mercury. Then what?
Venus.
And then Earth, right? Mars. Jupiter. Saturn. And then we have, again, our fixed sphere of stars. Where do we put the moon in the heliocentric model?
Around the Earth,
right? That's where it belongs, right? Because that one we can sort of tell that it's orbiting around the Earth pretty easily. Because how else do you explain that sometimes it goes in front of the sun, but it's not orbiting the sun itself? So the Earth goes around the moon. Technically, that statement is true. We will talk about that when we talk about gravity a little bit more. So the Earth orbits around the moon, and the rest of the planets orbit the sun directly as well. How do you explain retrograde motion? Sorry, I didn't say the phrase retrograde motion before. Retrograde motion is when things move backwards in the sky, right? Retrograde. That is the most we will talk about astrology in this class. And so I'm sorry if that's why you're here. I don't think that any of you are here for that. How do you explain retrograde motion in the heliocentric model? Who over here was gesturing with their fingers before? Yeah.
So at like a bigger circle, or like a bigger orbit, so it's just like farther out, it takes a longer time to get around.
Okay.
So if someone on a like smaller ring is going around it, it would like kind of get like near and then pass by and then like get farther away, kind of. So it would look like you'd be getting closer and then farther pushed. So in the night sky, it would like.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I'm going to draw some dots here, right? We're going to have four positions that each planet can be. I'm going to go back here. So, like you said, bigger orbits go slower. Right, we'll talk about that a little bit more in a second when we talk about Kepler's laws. But bigger orbits, the planets move slower. So that means that closer in orbits move faster, right? So the Earth orbits once, and Mars orbits less than once. right? So at some point, Earth is going to go past Mars in its orbit. So how does that look? If you draw out what we see from the Earth. So basically, what we're going to see is that as you look out, so this is position 1, 2, 3, and 4, right? As you look out, you will see Mars. Sorry, I'm not drawing this right. I should just steal the diagram from the book and not try and draw it. This is another thing you will learn about me over the next 15 weeks, is that I'm bad at drawing things. And in a class, when you have to do a lot of drawing, that makes things difficult. All right, now, let's see if I actually have the diagram here that I can drop in, explaining retrograde motion. Yes, okay, here we go. The Earth is moving in its orbit around this smaller circle. Mars is moving in its orbit around this bigger circle more slowly than the Earth is moving in its orbit. So the Earth is passing Mars, and as you look out towards Mars, if you look at this position, you see Mars go that way, right? It's this direction, then this direction, then this direction, then this direction. Now you've passed it. Now it looks like it's back over here. You keep moving past it, but eventually it just starts moving away and back in the same direction. Right? So you do a little flip here, right? You go and you flip the direction you're looking, and then it looks like it goes back the other way. So that's how you explain retrograde motion in the heliocentric model. It's just that smaller orbits move faster than bigger orbits, and you overtake the planet that's further out than you. And so it looks like it moves backwards in the sky, even though it doesn't actually move backwards physically in its orbit. Okay, so we have our heliocentric model. This explains things more simply than the geocentric model, in that we've reduced the number of perfect circles in our model down to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 from 14, 15 before, with all the epicycles counted in. So the heliocentric model was first proposed by Copernicus in the 1500s sometime, I think. Can't remember the date. We actually have a copy of the book in the library, in the rare books collection. It's pretty cool. Maybe we'll go see it sometime. Over time, so, you know, 1500, call it 1500, we start looking at the planets, trying to say, okay, now we have this better model. Can we predict where the planets will be in the sky in 2 months? That we can go and we can make better horoscopes for all our paying subscribers. And they start doing that, and then they go and look, and Mars isn't where it's supposed to be, based on the heliocentric model. If we have a perfect circle and we look at this point in the sky where it should be, it's not there. What does that mean?
It's not a perfect circle.
It's not a perfect circle. So now, how do you explain it?
They're elliptical.
What's an ellipse?
It's a circle that's like stretched out.
Yeah, basically, yeah. This is not a math class. This is an astronomy class. But we can drop in a diagram of how a circle works, at least. Or an ellipse, sorry. These are very small icons. And my vision is not very good. This looks like the right one. Here's an ellipse.
This is a little bit of a spoiler, but okay, that's fine. An ellipse is a shape where you have two foci, right, or focuses, or whatever. And basically what the ellipse is the line. If you kept the sum of r and r prime constant as you go sweep around an angle, that's the shape it makes, right? So imagine you have a bulletin board and you have a piece of string that's the same length, and you put two push pins in and put the string under the push pins and tried to draw a shape with the string, you would get an ellipse. So orbits are ellipses. Circles are a special case of an ellipse, where the two foci are at the same position, right? So you keep that, you get a circle when you draw the ellipse where the two foci are at the same position. So in theory, orbits can be circular. There's a bunch of different letters and stuff on here, right? The two important ones to know for our particular use in astronomy are A and E. So A is what we call the semi-major axis. Which is half of the long width of the ellipse. So this is, do it in blue. Right, that's A. So the full width of the ellipse is 2A. There's also the short side, like this. That's B, that's the semi-minor axis. And then E, do that one in red. E is what we call the ellipticity or eccentricity. It's a measure of how squashed it is, basically. So E is defined ellipticity or eccentricity. You'll sort of see those two words used interchangeably, or at least I'll use them interchangeably. It may not be strictly defined as the same thing, but they mean the same concept. This is defined as the square root of 1 minus b over a squared. So it's basically the ratio of these two tells you how squashed it is, right? As b gets smaller, a has to get bigger. So it tells you how squashed. A good shorthand for remembering how ellipticity and eccentricity work is that an eccentricity of 0 is a circle, and an eccentricity of 1 is a straight line, basically. So they're the shapes that are expressed in the 0 and 1, right? So a perfect circle is a 0, and the completely flat ellipse is a straight line, basically. So how does this factor in to our idea of how the solar system works, how orbits work in the solar system? So we're going out, we're saying, okay, Mars isn't where it's supposed to be, and a guy named Kepler, Johannes Kepler, thought, okay, I can explain that by using an ellipse instead of using a circle. And so he developed three laws. Kepler's first law says that planets orbit in ellipses. With the sun
at one focus of the ellipse. Hence this little picture of the sun here on the diagram from the book. So that holds true for the heliocentric model, right? Because a circle is an ellipse, and this the two foci are both at the center of that ellipse, and so the sun is at one focus of the circular ellipse. It's just also at the other one at the same time. So that's Kepler's first law. This explains that orbits are different shapes than circles. They're not perfect circles anymore. And when you use an ellipse, you can accurately predict where you should find the planet in the sky 2 months from now based on what you think the orbit is. But that's not all he did. We'll talk about the rest of that tomorrow. I want to give you a few more definitions before we go. So, if we're looking at elliptical orbits, right, we can, just based on the mathematics, the geometry of the shape itself, we can define a few terms to help us describe the orbits better. So, the first two of these are what we call the periapse, which is the closest approach to the sun. Strictly speaking, that's not true. It's the closest approach to the star. If we want to call it the closest approach to the sun, we would call it perihelion. This is where this class turns into a linguistics class and all the different stem and root words and prefixes and suffixes and stuff. There are different ways of describing orbits, right? It's not just that planets orbit around the sun, but the moon orbits around the Earth, right? Satellites, rockets orbit around the Earth. The sun orbits around the galaxy. Other planets orbit around other stars, right? There's different ways of combining this word. So if you orbit around the Earth, it's perigee. Orbits around the Earth are still elliptical. All orbits are elliptical. If you orbit around a star, it's periastron. It's just that we have a special name for the sun. And if you orbit around the galaxy, it's perigalactican. And don't ask me to spell that right the first time. I got it. How you find that is by saying, we'll call it RP, and that's equal to the semi-major axis, remember, which is half of the width of the ellipse, the long width, times 1 minus the eccentricity. Simple as that. The other quantity is the apoapse, which is the furthest that the planet gets from this whatever it's orbiting, right? So for the sun, that's aphelion, apogee, apoastron, things like that. And so how you find that, anybody want to guess, is RA, and it's the semi-major axis times 1 plus the eccentricity of the ellipse. So that's how you find those two things, right? So what's a good thing to note at this point is that even though the orbits in the solar system aren't perfect circles, they're really close to perfect circles. The The eccentricity of, is there a question? No. I thought I heard someone say something. The eccentricity of Earth's orbit is 0.017.
So it's basically 1% different than a circle. If you want to think about it that way, 2% different than a circle, which is not that much different if you really think about the change.
So basically, the closest Earth comes to the Sun is, well, we should first describe what the average distance of the Earth from the Sun is, which we call an astronomical unit. Which is, frankly, a bad name, because they're all astronomical units if you think about it. But this one is specifically called the astronomical unit, or AU for short. And the definition of the AU is the mean distance between the Earth and the Sun. So by mean, we mean average, not like, you're bad, I don't like you. This is also not a statistics class. That distance is 150 million kilometers, approximately, or 93 million miles. Approximately. And we will often see this described as the semi-major axis of Earth's orbit. And so 150 million kilometers is equal to 93 million miles, which is equal to 1 AU. So A Earth is 1 AU. It's 2 o'clock, so we'll leave it there. We will talk about the rest of Kepler's laws on Wednesday and go on from there. So thank you all for coming to class today. I'm glad that we're all in the same room again, and I will see you hopefully all again on Wednesday. Reminder that my office hours begin now if you want to come talk to me.